This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Radio is an intimate medium. Most of us listen while we're alone and in the privacy of our kitchens, cars, and earbuds. Millions of us enjoy listening to banter that might not pass muster in what used to be called polite company, raunchy and sometimes racial humor that pushes and sometimes crosses the line. Shock jocks often portray themselves as rebels who stand up against censorship from the FCC and their own bosses. And from time to time, the FCC will impose hefty fines. But as we learned from the Don Imus case, their bosses often encourage controversy and irreverence. They get ratings. The former shock jock on CBS Radio will settle their dispute over what his contract said and what it meant in court. But a few weeks after he was fired, what's changed? Where are the lines now? Later in the hour, the political junkie Ken Rudin joins us. If you have questions about the first Republican presidential debate, the mayoral election in Philadelphia, ever earlier primaries, or other developments in politics, you can email us now, talk@npr.org. But first, the post-Imus world of shock jock radio. Has anything changed? Should it? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Michael Harrison is publisher of Talkers Magazine, which covers the talk radio industry. He joins us from the Talkers Magazine studios in Springfield, Massachusetts. Nice to have you back on the program.
Great to be here, Neil. Thank you.
Is there any such thing as a rule book for shock radio DJs?
Not really, because, you know, the term shock radio is used in the press to describe a really wide variety of types. I mean, I saw a Newsweek the other day, Dr. Laura Schlesinger and Rush Limbaugh were described as shock jocks, which, of course, makes my skin crawl as somebody who sees talk radio from inside the industry. And understand that in this conversation, I'm presenting a view from inside the industry as opposed to outside the industry. So there really is no genre that has standard boundaries or no category that everybody subscribes to as being the word as to what a shock jock is.
It's one of those things, I guess, remembering that old Supreme Court decision, you know it when you hear it.
Exactly. And it's a term that people in the business don't even like to use, because you have to look at talk radio not as being isolated in a bubble separate from the rest of society. I mean, there's nothing that you can do on radio in the year 2007 that would be shocking. Radio is the most regulated of all the media out there, or one of the most regulated of all the media out there that's easily accessible to the general public, including children. We're awash in sexuality, eroticism, perversion, violence, nastiness, all kinds of bizarre stuff out there is considered modern popular culture. In some cases, it's even encouraged as being very hip. We see it on network television programs during the early evening hours. Mm-hmm. We hear it on the talk shows on television. Have you watched soap operas lately and the things they deal with? So to think of shock jocks, Don Imus said something shocking, the word shock itself, it doesn't apply to any kind of reality when you look at radio against the context of popular culture and society in America in 2007.
Well, evidently what he did say did shock some people, but we'll leave that aside for a moment. How big a sector of the talk radio industry is this kind of stuff?
It's a small sector of it. Most of the talk radio industry is standard news talk, and the subgenre of the talk radio industry that takes up a large percentage of, you know, if you were to measure words said on the radio, is sports talk. And then you have all kinds of...
Which can sometimes push some of those racial and sexual lines, too.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And sometimes we don't even know where the boundaries are between the kinds of radio we're talking about. For example, that which is often referred to as political talk radio, if you were to talk to any of its leading practitioners, they would tell you, every one of them, including Rush Limbaugh, hey, I don't just talk about politics. I talk about life. I talk about movies, culture, my personal life, what happened on the way to the station. A funny thing happened to me on the way to the studio, that type of thing. The boundaries between these academic subjects, English class is 1 to 2, so right. Social studies, it doesn't really exist in the reality of talk radio.
One of the things that we found quite interesting after this whole brouhaha erupted over Don Imus was what his contract had to say, that in fact that there was a clause in there that CBS management understands that this is going to be controversial and irreverent, and it encourages him to be so.
Oh, my goodness. You mean that they weren't victimized and surprised by what he did? My goodness. I'm glad that that came out because as somebody that, you know, I'm often a go-to guy. The press often comes to me and I listen to all the questions and I'm always explaining to the press that performers on the radio are not operating in their own entrepreneurial, you know, kingdom. They are hired to do what they're doing. It's like the old Mission Impossible, Neil, where we're going to send you on this impossible mission, and if you get caught, the secretary will disavow any knowledge of the mission. You're on your own, kid. This is what they do to so-called shock jocks. They want you to push the envelope. They want you to be sensational, provocative. They want you to do whatever it takes to get ratings and generate revenue. But if, for some reason, the backlash, the heat, supersedes your value to the station or the network, oh, we're concerned about our image, and we're not going to have this person here any longer, and they fire you, like, as though they were victimized.
And what has changed in the world after Don Imus was fired?
Well, nobody is saying nappy-headed hoe anymore, unless you're saying it with quotes around it in a clinical sense. I've heard it more on the radio since he's been there than I ever heard that said. Beyond that, I don't know. I don't know how that relates to people being nasty. I don't know how that relates to people being sexy. And I don't know how that relates to the double standard that still exists in terms of some people can say nasty things about certain races if they are of those races or religions, but others can't. And where do you draw the line? I mean, how dark does somebody have to be black? How many of one's parents must or ancestors have to be Jewish to be qualified to say a Jewish joke? In other words, where do we draw the line as to who's qualified to be racially insulting or ethnically insulting and who's not? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if anything has changed or if anything really should change.
It's interesting. We invited any number of, we'll use the term coming out of my mouth, shock jocks to join us on the radio. And one, Elliot Siegel of Elliot in the Morning here on DC 101 in Washington agreed to appear on the program. Then we got this email from him about an hour and a half ago. I'm sorry to email just prior to the segment, but as it turns out, I will not be able to be on with you today. Some concerns on the company side are preventing me from doing it at this time. Perhaps in the future I'll be able to assist you. Sorry for the confusion. Gracious of him to apologize, but it does suggest maybe some people are feeling a little gun-shy.
Well, of course, because, look, these people are employees of corporations. What do you expect them to go on another medium, a competing corporation, if you will, whether it's public radio or whatever, and say things that are family secrets about their employers? It's not about to happen. Not if they want to keep their job.
Also with us is Mark Fisher, a columnist for The Washington Post, the author of Something in the Air, Radio, Rock, and the Revolution. And he joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on the program, Mark.
Great to be with you, Neil.
And I know that you've spoken with a few, we'll use the term shock jocks. What are some of the things they've told you about their sense of responsibility and the way their world has changed?
Well, their world has changed only a little bit, and it's changed repeatedly when we have these kind of ritual purification exercises that take place after a little scandal. We saw this after the Janet Jackson breast reveal at the Super Bowl a few years ago, and quite a number of these shock jocks, particularly the ones on the FM raunch stations, the ones that call themselves Hot Talk. These are the stations where you have the morning shows where there's a lot of talk about exotic sex acts and that sort of thing. And a lot of those jocks were called in by their managers after that, just as they have been now after Don Imus, and told, let's cool it for a while. Tone down the language, a few of the phrases that maybe push the envelope, reel those back in, and stop doing some of the call-in segments that you were doing, the strip shows that some of them did, or they would have listeners call in to describe various sex acts. So you don't hear that for a time. But then they end up going right back there because, as these DJs tell me again and again, this is what they are paid to do. They are there to build ratings. We are in a society where the harder you push that envelope, the higher the ratings will be. Management knows that, and management tries to thread to kind of weave a path between the desire to have the content on the air be controversial and so that listeners will say, hey, did you hear what's on this station?
Right.
Versus the desire to appeal to advertisers and assure them that they will not be put in the situation that IMUS's advertisers were put in. So the management is very cautious about this, and they will never talk on the record about it because they are really playing both sides of the coin. And the performers are caught knowing that the managers want them to be as controversial as you can be until the public reacts. And what's new here is what IMUS was trapped in, which is the YouTube trap. Because what happened here is, unlike, you know, radio is ephemeral. It goes out over the airwaves. If I hear something outrageous, I might tell you about it,
right,
but it doesn't really become a big stink.
You wait 4 years for the reviews from Alpha Centauri.
Exactly. But TV and anything on video is now different because it gets immediately transferred to YouTube. Don Imus had the misfortune to have his radio show be simulcast on MSNBC. Therefore, there was video available of this moment, which was immediately posted on YouTube, and he was toast.
And so it echoed and echoed and echoed. And
Because you have something you can latch onto. It's something visible.
And is this some kind of a crossroad, or is this just another, as you say, episode of ritual purification?
Well, I think it's just one more of these rituals, but it is different in that you probably will now have a generation of managers of radio talk shows and stations who will say, you know what, we don't want to do that simulcast with the TV station because it really does expose us to a lot more than we really want to be exposed to.
We're talking with Mark Fisher of the Washington Post and author of a book about the history of radio called Something in the Air, and also with Michael Harrison, who's the publisher of Talkers Magazine. If you'd like to join us, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Howard Stern, Don Imus, those are names people recognize, but plenty of other shock jocks push and sometimes cross the line. Today we're talking about talk radio post-Imus. Michael Harrison is still with us, the publisher of Talkers Magazine. Also with us, Mark Fisher of the Washington Post. And, of course, you're welcome to join the conversation. Has anything in radio changed since Imus was fired? And should it? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say and submit your own comments on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And let's get Patrick on the line. Patrick is with us from Massachusetts.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is that I think IMUS would have done a lot better forwarding, the message if he was allowed to stay on air. You know, he should have been fined and suspended. But moving forward, the discussion would have been brought forth more if he was involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, secondly, besides NPR, the Daily Report, the Colbert, the Daily Show, the Colbert Report, Imus in the Morning gave me a lot of news and a lot of good news. And it's left a huge void in my morning radio.
Hmm. I wonder, Michael Harrison, it wasn't so much, was it really the advertisers who ended up pulling the plug on Don Imus?
I think what pulled the plug on Don Imus was the nervous Nelly executives at CBS and NBC who felt that they were under extraordinary pressure and highly embarrassed by the high visibility of it. The advertisers would have come back eventually. They were just doing what they had to do. They were nervous too.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes am very cynical about these things. When the first advertiser said that they were pulling out, I don't remember whether it was Staples or Bigelow Tea or someone, and they had their nice big logo on the evening news as having pulled out, you can be sure all the other advertisers sat around and said, let's pull out, because we can't not be up there too. we'll look like we're racist, and we can always come back later. So I just see hypocrisy all over the place when it comes to how this was handled. And as the caller mentioned before, I think they should have kept him on the payroll. Why'd they have to fire him? Take him off the air. Come out. Be honest. Say, hey, we take responsibility for this. We try to have the edgiest, spontaneous, sometimes the wrong thing comes out of somebody's mouth, but it's spontaneous, it's live, popular culture entertainment. Perhaps there's a sea change in how people react to these things. Perhaps it went over the line. It was a mistake. We take responsibility. Imus is not responsible. We pay him to do this. We take responsibility. We're taking him off the air, but we're not going to punish him. He's not a criminal. He's not a bad child who did something wrong. We're going to keep him on the payroll. We're going to take him off the air. We're going to analyze this situation, and we're going to do what we think is right for the benefit of the public, for the benefit of the African-American community, all minorities, all peoples, our advertisers, etc. And if, in fact, it's time to change our programming to fit changing times, we will do so. But Imus is a person who's been with our company for years. There are many people in this country who like him. Their rights have to be considered, too. Maybe we can use him in some other capacity, or he will change his act using his intellect and his talent to a productive end, and we will see. But no, they fired him, which was in many ways a nervous, cowardly act, and they shouldn't have done that.
Mark Fisher, I wonder what you think.
Well, I think the role that the advertisers played was really a good deal larger than that. I think there is, especially in radio, as in newspapers or television, and all of these old media that are very much in decline right now, and seeing their audiences dissipate, they don't really see a clear way into the future. And so there's an extra level of panic and of caution. And so when something like this blows up, these industries are especially susceptible to advertiser pressure. And that's, I think, part of what happened here. But the Imus program was especially susceptible to this because he uniquely mixed two worlds. He was, on the one hand, one of these FM hot talk raunch radio jocks. On the other hand, he ran...
Though a lot of his stations were on AM.
Exactly. And at the same moment, he ran a very highfalutin political talk program that drew the likes of Tim Russert and John McCain and many other big names from Washington. Mm-hmm. And it was that blend, that unique mixture that proved to be terribly toxic for Imus, because he ended up being held to a higher standard than we hold almost all of the other so-called shock jocks on the radio, from whom we expect this kind of nonsense and this kind of ugliness. And the irony here is that there are literally hundreds of talk show hosts across the country who on a daily basis say things that are as bad or far worse, far uglier and nastier on the radio. They say it every morning, and their audience is there for that reason. They expect that. Imus, because he was on a cable TV news operation that takes itself seriously and presents itself as a serious news operation, because of that, he was caught when he crossed a line into extreme nastiness. He was held to the same standard that we might perhaps hold the politicians who are his guests.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Patrick, thanks for the call.
Very, very well. Thank you.
So long. Let's go now with Ben, and Ben's with us from Westport in Massachusetts.
Yes, I have a question. I'm curious as to whether or not this whole incident reached such a crescendo because of the fact that the target, the recipients of this, the basketball team, were quote-unquote innocent victims as opposed to, for instance, a high-profile politician or somebody who might be considered more fair game.
Yeah, he said a lot of ugly things about Hillary Clinton, but Hillary Clinton can defend herself.
Right.
And she doesn't have a problem with it. Or was it more a fact that the semantics that he used? Had he said nappy-headed young ladies, would this have been okay? Had he said African-American hoes, would that have been okay? Was it the combination of the three words?
I'm not sure any of us are quite qualified to parse the semantics that carefully.
No, but I don't think it's a matter of those individual words, but I think your first point is exactly right. There's even a case in point happening just in recent days. Rush Limbaugh has been repeatedly airing a parody song, which is a criticism of Barack Obama, in which Barack Obama is called the Magic Negro. And this is a song that goes on at some length to criticize Obama in very racially tinged manner. And there are certainly folks out there who don't like the Rush Limbaugh program, who are trying to make an Imus kind of incident out of this, and they're not getting any traction for exactly the reason that you mentioned. This is, you know, the Imus really was a different kind of program from Limbaugh on the one hand, and also from the shock jocks on the other.
And Michael Harrison, I suspect that was at least certainly part of the reason that Don Imus certainly was abject in his apologies about what he said.
Well, I think that he was abject in his apologies because he realized he was in trouble, and I think he was probably under pressure from his management to do so as they were still trying to salvage his employment there. I was going to say his career, but his career is far from finished. It's probably going to be bigger than ever. And he might even wind up going back to the same company that wiped their hands of him as soon as the short-term memory of the American public creates another kind of purification. I like that term, Mark. What do you call it? The ritual purification.
Ritual purification. Yes.
Very cool. But I think that Imus got caught in a perfect storm. I think that the African-American community has had an ongoing in-family argument about the split between the hip-hop culture and the more conventional culture as to the use of these words. And I think that the African-American community is very sensitive when that argument spills out into the general public. I think the idea of a 66-year-old white man, you know, acting like a 21-year-old black man, which is all Imus tried to do. He just really was age and race inappropriate. I don't think he meant it to be a racist. I also don't think he saw these girls as innocent. They're champion basketball players who are on TV and kind of famous in their own world. I just think he was stupid in how he did it, but I don't think that he meant any harm. And I think that he stepped on a time bomb in terms of that whole African-American argument going on. He was the last straw, and tremendous frustration poured out, and Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton knew just how to play it. Mm. And you mentioned before a lot of people were shocked by this. I think they were only shocked after it went through the echo effect of YouTube and the politicization of it and then the media piling on. I think most people didn't care. And I find also personally, these girls, their moment was ruined. I don't think they would have even known about it if it weren't for all these people telling them that their moment was ruined. Back to me being cynical and thinking there's a lot of hypocrisy here. So there are so many factors involved in why Imus got caught in that trap at that moment. You can't say it's any one of them.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Ben. Appreciate it. Let me ask you both. Mark's point earlier, radio ratings are in general in decline as people try to reach out to gather whatever audience remains. It's certainly still considerable in the case of many millions of people who listen to the radio, and we thank you all. Nevertheless, as if this trend continues, Michael Harrison, do you think the trend is going to be towards more outrageous behavior rather than less?
No, I don't think so. I think that the trend toward outrageous behavior is societal. I think to point to radio as being outrageous is to miss the whole point. Radio simply has historically been, at least in the modern era, going back to, say, the 50s, it's the street medium. It was where we heard rock and roll when our parents thought rock and roll was bad. It's always been the place where you found out what the latest hip, edgy stuff was. And now we have all these post-war baby boomers getting older and still being kind of hip and kind of out there and still looking to radio, and that's why talk radio is so edgy. But the fact of the matter is, we have this kind of bad behavior in music, we have it in movies, we have it on network television. The internet is certainly the home of pornography for children of all ages, and the pornographic business is as big as sports. So to point to radio because it's desperate, because it's in some type of decline, as being the place that's bad is to miss the whole big picture about what's going on in the world.
Mark? No, I think there's a, you know, we could have an endless argument about chicken or egg here, but I think there is history that teaches us that talk radio became raunchy and explicit not because the society had changed, but because of specific events that happened. The advent of satellite technology, the congressional and FCC decisions to lighten up on regulation of content on the radio, the elimination of the fairness doctrine, that's what opened the floodgates for a much more explicit kind of talk on the radio, both political and sexual. And before that, you had a much more benign kind of talk on the radio, perhaps a more boring kind of talk. But those are the events that changed the nature of talk radio. Yes, it's true we live in a much coarser society now than we once did, but there are areas of the media that do reflect that, and there are areas that don't. Certainly on satellite radio, you can hear every kind of curse word ever imagined.
And every song Frank Sinatra ever recorded.
Well, yes, absolutely. There are other aspects of the media, particularly that which is available to children during prime time, which have traditionally been held to a higher standard of language and of topics. And that's the piece that we've kind of lost or at least been struggling with over the last decade. And we're in this sort of pendulum that swings back and forth between the allowing the extreme language and recoiling against it.
We're talking about talk radio post-IMUS with Mark Fisher of The Washington Post and with Michael Harrison, the publisher of Talkers Magazine, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Mel on the line. Mel's with us from Winston-Salem in North Carolina. Hello, Mel, you there?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would just like to make a couple of statements, please.
Go ahead.
First off, I think that a great amount of the popularity that these disc jockeys have is because they are saying things that the majority of people at one time or another actually think but never say. So when someone says something that people agree with privately, publicly, they're going to be elevated in some people's minds. Also, I'm of an age that I remember back when IMUS first started on radio only, and from my recollection, IMUS has always been in a certain vein, poking fun at everything that came along, religion,
mm-hmm.
whatever. And I just don't think that the situation merited the outcome. That's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the appeal of anybody on the radio is because they're going to say things that people are interested in hearing, or whatever that may be. And as I pointed out earlier, people do listen to radio in this little cone of privacy, Mark.
Absolutely. There is an intimacy to radio that is unlike that of any other medium. And the caller is absolutely right. It is there is a privacy. In this conversation where the person on the radio is talking to you and it feels like a one-on-one conversation, add to that the privacy of the car, which is one of the last places where you can kind of be alone in the society, and longer times that people spend commuting to work, and also the change in the atmosphere in workplaces where people are much more cautious about what they say than they may have been at a previous time.
Against it, which makes these kind of talk more appealing.
Exactly. And so these talk show hosts become a kind of a stand-in for what many people would like to feel that they could say someday, if they could ever say what was really on their minds at the office or at home or with their friends or in the neighborhood. And the car becomes that one place where it can all be vented. And so stations have found that there's an enormous ratings bonanza to be had if you get out there and say all the things that may be lurking in the minds of people, things that they might really never say, even if they did mm-hmm. have that opportunity. So it is a kind of a venting of the national id. And that's a good thing, I think. And when we try to quash that and silence it, I think we are potentially doing damage because people do need an outlet, even if it's not their own voice.
Mm-hmm. Michael Harrison, I'm going to give you the last word. And one of the things that's been of interest to me is the number of people who are working in the radio business who grew up doing stand-up in clubs. And again, pushing that sort of line where the kind of things, these kind of things are fairly tame.
Yeah, a lot of people are former stand-up comics. Some are former lawyers. You know, people come from all kinds of discredited fields. But just if I have the final word, you mentioned Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra sang about tramps. He sang in praise of drinking and driving, one for my baby and one more for the road. Nothing's changed. We're not in a dirtier, more funky, crude society now. It's just modernized. If you look back at the history of art, the history of communication, the history of societies, the history of IMUS, it's nothing's new. It's just new words, just new names and categories. A case could be made we're a more civil society today than we were in the 50s. It was just couched differently. So let's not fall victim to believing things are getting worse and uglier now. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're in the now, so it seems more intense.
Michael Harrison, the publisher of Talkers Magazine, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Mark Fisher, Washington Post columnist, author of Something in the Air, Rock, Radio, and the Revolution. He was with us here in Studio A 3A. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And when we come back, the political junkie will be talking about New Hampshire and its even earlier primary. It's the talk of the nation from NPR News.